from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. 1 year ago today, the unthinkable happened. Two explosions near the finish line of the Boston Marathon in the midst of joyous crowds, families, and exhausted runners. A stunning terror attack that left three dead and more than 260 wounded. Days later, Boston went on lockdown. Tamerlan Tsarnaev was killed in a police shootout. His younger brother, Jakar, goes to trial in November and faces the death penalty. This hour on Point, 1 year later, what we've learned and how terrorism experts are thinking about threats in this country now. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. How do you think about terrorism now? How's it stack up against Sandy Hook, Aurora, Kansas City? What are we learning as we go? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first in the studio today is David Boeri, senior reporter at WBUR Boston, our home station, who's been closely following all the information that's come out since the marathon bombing a year ago today. David, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. You're welcome.
What have we learned since those first chaotic hours after the two bombs went off on Boylston Street in Boston, very near the finish line, about these two young men, alleged bombers, one now dead, and why they did it, and whether it should have been detected earlier, their plan?
It's interesting, Tom. There's still much not known about why that may never be answered. We know that Tamerlan Tsarnaev went to Dagestan in 2012. He went there, and even though he was on a terrorist watch list, he left the country without being screened. He left the United States without being screened. He stayed 6 months there.
This is a troubled area of Russia with a lot of unrest and Islamic fundamentalism.
Ethnically
is there.
Chechen. It's all part. The Russians, their security service had warned the United States in March 2011 that Tamerlan Tsarnaev and his mother, Zubaydah Tsarnaeva, were both being radicalized. They were both talking about Islamic Jihad, and he would be going to Russia. That triggered a three-month assessment. The FBI, at the end of the three-month assessment, closed it. But they knew he was going. He went, was not screened. He was on the watch list. What he did while in Dagestan is still unclear. The FBI sent teams after the bombing to Dagestan to find out. They come back. The FBI is still convinced he was a homegrown terrorist. And by that, Tom, we mean his second homeland, namely the United States.
Reportedly did not figure out how to make this bomb in Dagestan, but did it from, an online magazine sitting in the United States?
That's right. Much like the Anarchist Cookbook, you could go online and find how to make a pressure cooker bomb. You could go there. I've got the website. I downloaded it. It's fairly easy. It's fairly easy to do. The Russians were concerned that he was joining bandit underground groups in Dagestan, ethnically Chechen, that have been at war with Russia, both in Dagestan and Chechnya. But there doesn't seem to be any evidence of it that's emerged.
What does the FBI say now about the months and years leading up to the attack? When they look at it, do they say, you know, we should have seen this or we couldn't see it, if not why?
They have engaged in a strenuous defense of their action. They say at the end of the day, some of them say that, in fact, they would have done everything the same, that they wouldn't have gotten the results. But you have to understand that since 9/11, the FBI has been reprogrammed, repurposed, and rebranded as America's chief counterterrorist force. All the other things that we used to associate with the FBI are gone. They are now the elite counterterrorist force.
So how did this happen?
That's the subject of all these various reports. And although some of them blame the Russians at a time, by the way, when it's easy to blame the Russians.
Yeah, and it's not going to get better anytime soon.
There are very troubling things when you look at them as to what happened. For instance, the FBI agent, part of the Joint Terrorist Task Force, the FBI is now all about these partnerships. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They go out. The agent goes out to do an assessment of Tamerlan Tsarnaev. He meets Tsarnaev, and one question you would think he would ask, it's fairly obvious since the Russian said he's planning to come here and he's been radicalized. There's no record. In fact, the agent said he didn't ask him where he was going in Russia and why he was going. So you look at that, and it's amazing. Now, even though that they closed the assessment after 3 months, this is the FBI, they then notify the Russians who wanted more information, and implausibly and ludicrously, they refer to Tsarnaev as a former prosecutor in Kyrgyzstan. Imagine the Russians' reaction to
that. Nothing to
do
with Kyrgyzstan, and he's nothing like a prosecutor.
Laughing. It's ludicrous on the face of it. However, they did... The Russians did send information to the CIA, the same information they'd sent in March. That resulted in him being put on the terrorist watch list, so that he was on that watch list when he bought a single one-way ticket from Moscow in December 2011 and left in January 2012.
We've heard so much in this last year about NSA surveillance of all kinds of Americans, not least those on FBI watch lists. What does this say about all the surveillance and what it can produce and what it did not produce in this case?
There is a very significant communications problem. After these reports, these reviews have come out, the FBI's made it clear they've changed their communications policies.
But let with me give you, local law enforcement, with each other?
With their partners, their so-called partners. Mm-hmm. But here is an example of what went wrong. You have, because he's on the terrorist watch list, when he buys a one-way ticket, the Customs and Border Protection agent who sits next to or alongside that FBI agent mm-hmm. gets notified. Somebody on the watch list.
Mm-hmm.
Neither the Customs and Border Protection guy or the FBI agent in the same room can remember whether they talked to each other. There's no record that they talked to each other, so the FBI has no record and it took no action after that trigger, the terrorist watch, that he had bought a one-way ticket. Same thing happens on the way back in. Now, had they reopened that assessment that in June 2011 said, we can't find anything wrong, had they opened that up and done more database searches, they might have found a criminal record. Remember, in September 2011, three people are murdered in Waltham, and friends of the victims.
It's a Boston suburb. It looks like he's involved in that, and it looks like a drug murder.
Friends of the victims say, you know what? One of the victims' best friends, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, never showed up at the funeral. This is suspicious. They went to police. A trigger of criminal data searches might have picked that up. Meanwhile, they never interviewed, the FBI agent never interviewed either his girlfriend, who he assaulted in 2009, or his wife, who could have talked about the radicalization.
David, if law enforcement had been perfect here, do you think this would have been avoided somehow? I mean, they could still go and buy pressure cookers. They could still buy ball bearings. You can't live in their house.
Tom, to be fair, we are talking about eliminating, reducing to zero the risks of terrorist actions. And everybody wants to prevent this, obviously, seeing all the tragedy. Can we get to zero? I think it's impossible you're ever going to eliminate the risk. However, looking back, we can see things that could have been done differently, that should have been done differently, that cry out. And part of this is the sharing of information. In June 2011, when the FBI agent was making an assessment of Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the Boston Joint Terrorist Task Force was making 1,000 assessments of potential problems.
He was one among 1,000.
Right. And you go back. You know, you look at the peak at that pyramid, Tom, now, and you see Tsarnaev at the top. And you go back and you can follow him. You can walk him backwards. And it all becomes clear to you at the junctures. Oh, yeah, this is what did it. This was mm-hmm. did it. At the end, at the base, there are thousands of would-be Tsarnaev. So it's easier looking backwards. But there were some very fundamental mistakes and things that happened here. If you eliminate them, would we have eliminated what happened? I don't know. That's the great question. Everybody wants to think so. Everybody wants the FBI to do better. We have to do better.
The younger brother sits in prison. Of course, he was finally taken into custody after his older brother Tamerlan was shot in the shootout with police. Trial coming up in November. Death penalty is facing him. And what are we likely to learn in this trial?
Like the trial of another notorious FBI character, namely Whitey Bulger. I don't think we're going to find a lot new, but there's one element here, Tom, of this coming trial that's going to be very, very important. The defense is going to be fighting for his life. He is facing the death penalty on 17 counts. And what they're saying now, they've already said that the family will say that the FBI approached the older brother, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, in order to make him an informant. Now, the FBI vehemently denies that they ever approached him or ever turned him into an informant.
What would the significance be if they had approached him to become an informant?
This is huge. You go back to the history that the FBI doesn't like. There's a new FBI, and yet they're faced with that history. The greatest failure, and people in Boston know this well, James Whitey Bulger, an FBI informant, they hid him from their partners, state and local police. The suggestion here is they hid Tsarnaev, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, from the locals.
Is there any substantiation of that beyond speculation?
What we know is that the FBI did not notify its state and local partners, and the chief of police in Boston, Ed Davis, said as much after the bombings. They were never notified by the FBI that the Russians had notified the FBI that Tsarnaev was planning a trip to Russia and that he had become radicalized.
If that connection could be proved, what difference would it make to the younger brother's defense?
The defense is pulling out all the stops, looking for mitigating circumstances, and they're going to pull out the defense. They will have people who will say that, in fact, they saw the FBI trying to talk Tamerlan Tsarnaev into becoming an agent.
So what? What's it have to do? People are still dead.
That's right.
The limbs are still lost.
Absolutely. They will make a sense that they created this instability in the older brother. Whether it sells to the jury is another matter. But they're going to push at that angle. And so we get this past history of the FBI that unfortunately comes forward. They insist he was not an informant. They didn't try to make him an informant.
All this awaits us in the trial in November. A year ago today, the bombing hit Boston at the marathon, near the marathon finish line. David Boeri, senior reporter with WBUR, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome, Tom.
Raw sound there from the finish line at the Boston Marathon last year. The first explosion there, and seconds later came another. Three died, more than 260 wounded, 16 with limbs amputated. It was a shocking, shocking day for the city and the country. Here's the sound of police, Boston's police department, scanner right after the explosions.
Units, stay off the air. Units, stay off the air. Just make your way over there. All units, stay off the air and make your way over there.
Help up from the medical tent. Get as many people up here as you can from the medical tent.
Definitely devices here, came that first word over the scanner. Here's Hannah Truslow. She was in the stands directly across from the first explosion.
We're in the VIP seating. There's Likawachi across the street, and we saw the first bomb go off, and people blow up in the streets, and then the one further down.
There was blood and limbs everywhere. Here's Jeff Curtis, 50 yards away from the explosions.
We're picking them up, putting pressure on wounds. A lot of people were hurt, and we just threw them, ran as fast as we could down here to get blood. They were banged up bad. Severe lacerations, amputees, a lot of shrapnel. You know, they were pretty big explosions.
1 year ago today, a year on, we're looking at what we've learned from that day's events and how experts think about our terrorism threat now in this country, 1 year after the Boston Marathon bombing. We're looking at national security, local security. Joining me now from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, is David Sid, Executive Director of the Memorial Institute for the Prevention of Terrorism. It's a training center in Oklahoma City to improve the policies and intelligence of the nation's 800,000 law enforcement officers. They began operations in April 2000 on the 5-year anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. David's a 20-year veteran of the FBI, served as a counterterrorism specialist, is author of Understanding Counterterrorism. David Sid in Oklahoma, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And with us from Durham, North Carolina today, David Schanzer, professor at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy, also director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security Research Consortium between Duke, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and the research institute RTI International. He was Democratic staff director of the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security from 2003 to 2005. David Schanzer, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
David Schanzer first. Can you put the Boston Marathon bombing in some kind of context for us? Do we live in a country today where national authorities, local authorities are constantly battling this kind of threat? Or do you see this 1 year on as an outlier, a one-off, an unusual, outside of expectation event?
Well, it's a little bit of both, Tom. We have this constant threat. It is not an existential one. It is not so frequent when you look at the data, especially compared to other types of violence that we have in our society, that it's one that should preoccupy us as a society. Yet, your first statement, do we have local and federal law enforcement agencies and others battling this concept? Yes, we do. We have a lot of resources that are dedicated to trying to find the small number of people who are inspired by these ideas to engage in violence, try to find out who they are and stop them before they do something like what happened 1 year ago.
David Sid, a year ago it was dubbed homegrown. 9/11, it was very much imported, very much something from outside. On balance, how do people in the terrorism prevention field look at the dominant manner of threat now, from the outside, from the inside, homegrown, otherwise?
Well, I think it's both, but what we do is we examine what terrorists must do before committing an act of terrorism, those laws of physics that constrain us all. And if we get down to that level, at the line officer, looking for those behaviors, and behavior-based is important, then I think we can look at the threat, parse it out, but in the final analysis, if somebody's going to do something in your city, they must prepare, and those preparatory activities are what we train the police to look for.
People talked about intelligence sharing after the Boston Marathon bombings, that there were things that were known which were not adequately communicated to the local police authorities. You work with local police a lot, David Sid. Is the flow of information from, we hear so much about national intelligence gathering, is that flow of information appropriately shared with local police departments today?
I think it's uneven. I think in some places it's shared well and in others not as well. But I think sharing is essential if we're going to prevent terrorism. That's one of the keystones of terrorism prevention, good intelligence sharing.
But you've said that if everything were shared, it would just overwhelm local police forces. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that it's similar to data mining. If you give local police everything that you've got in the FBI holdings on potential terrorism, it would be overwhelming because most of what they do has to do with public safety. And they're not really focused on terrorism as a major program as the FBI is. So it's important for the FBI to parse out what's good and what's not good to pass on. The difficulty is when they make a mistake in that regard.
Make a mistake in not passing on what would be useful?
Yes, that's right. Make a mistake in not passing on what's useful. And that's easy to do. The FBI is competent, but they're heavily burdened. I think your first speaker mentioned the thousands of threat assessments being done at the same time. That's quite a bit of work and quite a bit of energy involved in looking at people who are not doing anything inherently illegal, but yet may be posing a threat to commit an act of terrorism sometime in the future. It's very difficult to assess people in that regard and to make judgments about their potential for committing acts of terrorism. Clearly in Boston, mistakes were made, but it's very difficult to do.
David Panzer, step way back with us here and put all this in perspective. After 9/11, the whole country was wrapped up in terrible fear of terrorism. How do you see the threat today? Has it receded to something like pre-9/11 levels? I don't know if we were adequately assessing the levels before 9/11. Do we have a serious terror threat problem in this country? Last summer, when the intelligence community was kind of on trial over NSA revelations, you know, we were told that there were so many threats out there that if they talked to us about all of them, we'd be freaked out. Is that true?
Well, when 9/11 occurred, what we had was an international terror network that had successfully attacked us in 1998 in attacking, bombing two embassies, almost downed a large Navy destroyer in the port of Yemen, had engaged in other assassinations and plots around the world, and then had successfully infiltrated the United States, used planes as weapons, and knocked down two of our iconic buildings and attacked the Pentagon. So that is a substantial level of threat that we changed a lot of policies and invested a lot of money to deal with. That organization that did that is a shadow of its former self. The central al-Qaeda organization that attacked us from Afghanistan just does not exist in the same way that it does that it did then. It was deprived of its safe haven in Afghanistan. It's been under constant pressure with the drone attacks. Its financial resources have been sapped. Now, that threat has and that ideology has kind of mutated out into smaller affiliates, groups that are active, and we read about this all the time, and whether they're in Libya, other parts of North Africa, the Middle East, Pakistan. They continue to be active, but in my view, they are not quite as interested in attacks against the West, by and large, as central al-Qaeda was. They're fighting in Syria. They're fighting in Yemen, trying to topple local governments there. So that all that threat still exists, but I think it is at a lower level than it was a decade ago.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
No, but the last point is, the ideas that al-Qaeda has propagated and spread throughout the world do have appeal to small numbers of people, whether they be in Europe or the United States, places where there is not large-scale conflict and opportunity to engage in violence in pursuit of certain ideologies. It inspires some of them to take action on their own. And that's the threat that is present here. Again, I don't think it is an enormous one because I don't think these ideas have widespread appeal. But that is what led to the Boston Marathon bombing.
David Sid, what about that homegrown threat or issue? I was in San Francisco last week. The newspaper there was reporting that the Al-Qaeda magazine, Inspire online magazine, that the Sarnaya brothers reportedly got their bomb-making recipe from, is still out there promoting that. There was a photograph apparently of a train, tram car at the San Francisco airport, and this message online saying, you know, get going. Don't just sit there. Pack your tools of destruction. Assemble your bomb ready for detonation. Is that a serious provocation to activity in this country now? What about the homegrown threat, David?
Well, as David said, the threat is much diminished, but it's still present. And that sort of propaganda will always appeal to some who are weak of mind. But I think that compared to the immediate threat that we faced after 9/11, it's diminished significantly. As David mentioned, we have Al-Qaeda Central on the run, and the ideology has morphed, and others have taken it up. But they're more concerned with their local efforts and trying to move their agenda forward wherever they're fighting. But yes, there is always a potential for that, and that's what I think the FBI tries to sort out with these threat assessments. It's, as I said, it's a difficult business to do. And because terrorism is not a principal concern of most police departments and probably never will be because of all the other things they do, mm-hmm. The FBI has taken on the burden of doing most of the counterterrorism work. But it's essential that the state and local police become involved, because if they don't, we'll miss things and things will happen as they did in Boston.
David Sid, please stand by in Oklahoma City. David Schanzer in Durham, North Carolina. Scott's calling from Buffalo, New York. Scott, thank you. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, just a quick comment. I'll take your response off the air. I just want to thank these guys for all their hard work and just for all of us to be careful to place blame. You know, whenever you use the word blame in relation to Boston, it should really be placed on those two brothers and nobody else. Like you said, evil is in the world and always will be in the world, and let's just keep that in mind.
You're saying don't be too hard on the FBI? Is that your point, Scott?
I'm saying, yeah, don't be too hard on anybody who's doing their very best to halt this from happening. And whenever anybody wants to say the word blame the terrorists.
Scott, I appreciate your call. Let me get one more right behind it here, if I may. Sean in Nashville, Tennessee. Sean, you're on.
Hey, Tom. This is kind of a morbid thought, and I don't want to be insensitive, but I'm interested in your call and your guest's take on the cost difference between stopping all of these attacks or stopping all but one of these attacks. It seems that you approach an asymptote on the graph, and it would be astronomical to take that last step from one or two attacks a year to zero.
That's an interesting question. Thank you, Sean. David Shanzer, what about it? Are we putting the right resources against the threat as it exists today? And what about Scott's point? If we're asymptotically approaching zero here, if you try to do that, do you run into a sort of almost infinite cost? Not only in money, but maybe in civil liberties.
Well, that's absolutely the right question to be asking. We have to ask ourselves, what kind of society do we want to live in? So if those 1,000 people are all assessed and they're all found to not have anything happening with them, to not violate any criminal laws or have likely to be involved in criminal activity, do we want a society where we constantly keep those people's files open, where we're continuing to gather information on them, where we're restricting their movement, where we're engaging in surveillance on them? You can imagine a situation where if everybody who is part of the threat profile is continually made a suspect for the rest of their lives, that you begin to have a society that looks more like East Germany than the former East Germany than the society we want to have in the U.S. So those are the kinds of background things we always have to keep in mind. And I just want to make another point about the sharing of information.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed. We need to have a culture of sharing. But the more diffuse you share that threat information, the more implications it can have on the innocent. And it's also worth noting that it was Edward Snowden and Bradley, now Chelsea Manning, who took advantage of efforts that were put in place to make information more widely accessible to cause the leaks that led to a lot of harm to these federal agencies. So it's easy for us to be out there saying share, share, share. But then when people on the inside take advantage of these avenues in which we're sharing, the reaction then is to pull back in the other direction.
Many proper balances to be struck here, and not easy. William in Middleborough, Massachusetts. William, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Well, thank you for having. I sort of have a more interesting, less common perspective, where I was also at the finish line, like a lot of people were.
A year ago today, at the Boston Marathon.
Yeah, a year ago. I'm a photographer by trade, so everything, all of us who understand that, you sort of take everything in through the eyes and whatnot.
How close were you? Were you wounded? Was your family there?
No, my entire family was there. My parents flew up from Florida. My brother, he was running for a large charity for a former local athlete, and I'll say just as much as that. Google that, and you'll be able to find out. So protect, just to protect.
We just got a minute before the break. Was your family safe? Were they all right, William?
Mother lost her hearing in her left ear, and she still does not have it back altogether. Just to comment on all the mistakes that could have been made. I had a very expensive camera on my neck, and the state police grabbed me by the shirt and yanked us all over to the medical tent immediately. The FBI cards out of our cameras, as many images as we had, they wanted, to see if we caught anything on film. Now, they took 85 of my images, and as much chaos as was on the ground, I do have to give a lot of credit to the people that were there, all the agencies that were there already on the ground. I mean, they were scrambling just like all of us.
William, I appreciate your call. We're up against a break right here. William, who was at the finish line a year ago today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about national security, local security this hour, and how the experts think about our terrorism threat now, 1 year after the Boston Marathon bombing. There are plenty of things to be concerned about. Our listeners are voicing many of them here. Terrorism, certainly not the only one. David Sid joins us. He is executive director of the Memorial Institute for the Prevention of Terrorism in Oklahoma City. David Schanzer is here, professor at Duke University, Sanford School of Public Policy, joins us from Durham, North Carolina. David Sid, David Schanzer, let's comment online. You know, here's Nick says, we're more concerned about our rights eroding in plain daylight. It's easier to pay attention to terrorism than to what the Supreme Court is doing. Adam says, gun violence is a hugely more pressing issue, and yet we almost completely ignore it. Jerry Ann says, far more Americans are murdered and maimed by drunken drivers and people with guns. I mean, David Schanzer, as a relative threat, you know, we went into a real period of hyper-focus after 9/11. Do you think we've come to the sort of proper balance in the way we look at the terror threat up against all the other things facing our country now? Here's another listener who says, I'd worry more about the growing net of laws, detention without trial, internal spying, growing economic divide, etc. Do we have the right perspective on terrorism, David Schanzer?
I think we do tend to overhype the terrorist threat, but that's natural because terrorism by its nature is spectacular. It is designed to try to empower people who are very weak and who are few in number by the spectacular nature of the attacks that are perpetrated. So it's by design, and I think we are very wise when we try to put these types of threats in perspective, and that we respond very much like we did in response to the Boston Marathon by pulling together, by not pointing fingers at each other, as David Ortiz said in language we can't repeat on the radio, emphasizing this is our town, this is our country, and that makes us stronger after these events.
David Sid, people may look at this these days after Sandy Hook and all the other circumstances of mass shootings in this country and say maybe we need to redraw the line here. I mean, what is terrorism and what's not? Is Sandy Hook terrorism? Is Virginia Tech, is what we saw in Kansas City this week, a form of terrorism?
Well, what we try and do is we try and define terrorism as being politically or socially motivated. So violence based on personal animus or anger doesn't fall technically into the definition of terrorism. But the interesting thing about those events, in my mind, is that those same preparatory behaviors may occur before a shooting in a school as do before an act of terrorism. And that suggests to me that the model that we use to find these terrorism warnings and indicators, as we call them, may be something we can apply in the school environment. Again, not trying to create a Gestapo, because we know how we could have no terrorism. We could just lock down the country and have a Gestapo. They were a perfectly efficient police service. They didn't have any problems. But
the
we don't
Nazi
want that.
Police, yeah. Mm.
Yes, precisely. So I think that the model that we're using for terrorism offers some benefits there. But clearly there are other issues that should be higher in our thinking, and Sandy Hook is one. In my view, Sandy Hook should have been the 9/11 for school shootings, and it wasn't, and I, for the life of me, I can't understand why. But I think, yes, there are other issues that should be addressed and that are of a higher priority, clearly.
David Schanzer, what about the models that we exercise today, that we use? There's been so much talk about the NSA and surveillance, over-surveillance in this country in this last year since the Boston Marathon bombing. Is that appropriately placed criticism? And does it, if we chip away at that in the name of civil liberties, which people hold very dear, are we right to worry about the warnings from intelligence officials that we put ourselves, the country, at risk? Or, in your view, did the NSA go too far?
Well, let's first understand that the vast majority, even of the Edward Snowden revelations, were about NSA activities relating to communications abroad or either from people abroad into the United States who had foreign intelligence information. There's really only one program that's focused on Americans, and that was the collection of telephone billing records.
And quite a big one.
Every call, absolutely, yeah. quite a big one. Although the database, those records existed at the phone company, and the United States took them under its possession and then occasionally searched the database to try to find out if there were people that outside known terrorists were calling inside the U.S. So, you know, this is a debate we should constantly be having. I have no problem with that. We should also always be trying to understand the amount of risk that we're willing to accept in the realm of terrorism. And if we want to pull back and accept more risk, then we should do less surveillance, less police resources into this these activities. If we are at a point where we, you know what, we want to cut down on the amount of risk, then we're going to do some other things in that nature. That's the way it is. It's a constant flux.
Mary in Winchester, New Hampshire. Mary, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Two quick points. Mm-hmm. One is I think it's really important that we make a distinction between terrorism, terrorist acts, and then acts of violence like we saw with Sandy Hook. So that's my number one point. I think we have to make distinctions between young boys who are angry and struggling and might have mental illness and are using guns or perpetrating other acts of violence versus terrorism. And my second point is I would like to hear more in this conversation about how we are living in a culture of fear, that we are being inculcated in many ways about living in fear, functioning from fear. And as someone who's raising a daughter right now and keeps her very protected from mainstream media for lots of good reasons, I think this is a conversation that we need to be having as a culture and not talking so much about risk factors and understanding, you know, the minds of terrorists.
Mary, do you think, if I may ask you, do you think there's been too much attention in the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombing to what happened there? Is that part of your critique of a culture of fear?
I don't want to point out, I don't want to single out the Boston Marathon shootings because I'm from Boston originally. My father is running the marathon. I feel very, you know, it's a personal issue for me as well. I think it's really thinking broadly about how in our culture we're talking about issues of violence and operating from fear. And I understand that there is, you know, maybe more of a risk factor now than there was 20, 30 years ago. I'm not sure. I'm not an expert. But as a parent and as somebody who does teacher education, I feel like it's really important that we're thinking about how we talk about issues of violence, not always from fear, but maybe from understanding why people are perpetrating the kinds of crimes that we're seeing.
Mary, I appreciate your call very much. David Chandra, you've written recently, I mean, putting the marathon bombings and a lot more in context in the years since those bombings with their three deaths and lots of suffering, no doubt. But you've pointed out there have been 14,000 murders in the United States and 46 murders in Boston. What about Mary's point that we need to be careful about a culture of fear around the issue of terrorism? Psychologically, do you think we're at a healthy balance point on that, David, or not?
She's absolutely right about that. Your likelihood of being a victim in a terrorist incident is much less than being struck by lightning in the United States. And I think we should constantly, we live with a variety of risks. Terrorism is one of those that is a background risk that we have to accept as part of life. That doesn't mean we should, you know, not try to have a perfect law enforcement record and try to bring these incidents down to zero. But you know, like driving in a car, we know that we have a possibility of being in an accident, but we drive anyway. So we have to go about our lives, let the law enforcement agencies do whatever they can to stop these events from happening. But we can't, we shouldn't be preoccupied by whether it's the terrorist risk or the risk relating to gunmen in schools, both of which are horrible, but both of which are exceedingly rare.
David Sid, same question to you. We've looked at law enforcement intelligence, data collection here. What about our mental health, our psychological balance when it comes to terrorism? Are we getting towards something reasonable?
I think so. I think Mr. and Mrs. Front Porch have other principal concerns. I think people are aware of terrorism as an issue, but I don't see it as an overwhelming concern right now.
I think Boston's done pretty well in that regard, considering the significant hit that it took a year ago today. I'm grateful to the two of you for being with us. David Sid at the Memorial Institute for the Prevention of Terrorism in Oklahoma City. Thank you very much for joining us, David.
Thank you.
And David Chandra, director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security, joining us today from Durham, North Carolina. David Chandra, thank you so much for your insights today.
Thank you for having me.
In a moment, we will look at security preparations for this year's Boston Marathon. This is On Point. In 6 days, 36,000 runners will compete in the Boston Marathon, 9,000 more than a year ago. The city expects at least 1 million spectators, which would be double the crowd from last year. There will also be double the number of police officers. 3,500 will be along the route. The Boston Globe's Maria Kramer is following preparations to make the Boston Marathon a secure event. Maria, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
We got the raw number there, 3,500 police along the route, double the number of last year. What about other security precautions? What will be new, different, expanded this year in Boston?
I think the message from police is what you're going to see is a lot more of everything, a lot more crowds, a lot more runners, and definitely a lot more police. In addition to that, more cameras, at least 100 cameras have been added along the route going into Boston. You will have more bomb-sniffing dogs. You will have more plainclothes officers, you know, milling in the crowd on rooftops, just, you know, surveying people and watching for any suspicious activity.
What do you do with 100 cameras? Who's watching all of that film footage, or is it computer monitored?
Oh, that's a good question. It's 100 cameras in addition to, you know, the many cameras that are already along that route that have been installed there permanently. And what they're doing this year that they haven't done before is they're going to be feeding into one system so that all the multiple agencies that are involved in securing the route will be able to see in real time what's happening. That's something that they haven't done before. Before, you would have different agencies looking at video footage happening in their own jurisdiction. It was a little bit less organized. And this year, they're trying to funnel everything through one system so that you can view it in real time.
How do they double up the number of police officers along the route? How much of that comes from the Boston Police Force? How much from local forces? And how much is federal support?
Well, in Boston, for example, it's pretty much all hands on deck. That's the message. Last year, I think you had about close to 1,000. This year, you're going to have twice that. And then along the rest of the route, a lot of departments, the chiefs were saying to their officers, if you're not running, you're working. So everybody has been expecting to work pretty much since the attacks last year. All police departments, you know, had already instructed their officers that they should be prepared to work today.
What about coordination with federal law enforcement and intelligence agencies? Is it clear that that has been stepped up in the year since the marathon bombing a year ago? Will that be evident next week when the race is run?
Yes. What happened last year after the attacks is the meetings between state officials and local officials began a lot earlier, and there were a lot more meetings. You know, they would meet obviously to make preparations and to be more cohesive. But this year they stepped up the meetings. They had a lot more meetings, and they began the process just weeks after the attacks, so that they could be more coordinated this year. At the same time, jurisdictions are saying to them, are saying to the public, are saying to residents in their town, saying this is an event in Boston, this is an event in Ashland, this is an event in Brookline, and we are going to handle things the way that, you know, we believe is proper, is appropriate for our area.
And there's the experience of runners and spectators, of which there are many, many, many along this route. Here's a little tape of Kurt Schwartz, director of the Massachusetts Federal Emergency Management Agency, in March, outlining new steps to be taken this year to secure the race.
Please do not carry backpacks or over-the-shoulder bags. Please do not carry large coolers or large, bulky items. And please do not wear costumes or masks. And if you are going to carry personal items, we ask and urge you to carry them in clear plastic bags. Spectators approaching the course may pass through screening checkpoints where people who are carrying backpacks or other bags or bulky items may be asked to open their bags for inspection.
Maria Kramer, what about runners and spectators? You know what a family event this is. Lots of coolers get dragged out, typically, historically, along the route. People spend much of the day, having a picnic and watching the runners go by. How is the experience going to change for spectators, for runners?
That's been a big concern, you know, by police and the organizers of this race, is how do you secure this route and at the same time maintain that family atmosphere? Anybody who's been to the marathon has seen, you know, people are able to just rush to the runners and hug them. You know, in Wellesley, you know, the college students love to kiss the runners as they're passing by. It's very warm. It's very intimate. And it's unlike a lot of marathons in that way. So how do you keep that happening? And what they've said is that the screening checkpoints that they're going to have, they don't want them to be these onerous you know, checkpoints where you're, you know, being wanded with a security wand. They want basically people to be able to pass through. They just want, what they're urging is for people to be practical. Please don't bring anything bulky. If you bring something bulky, you're going to be searched and you're going to slow down the amount of time that you can get to the route and watch the runners. And at the same time, they're also telling officers, use common sense. If, you know, for example, there's some towns where the marathon passes right in front of people's front yards and people love to hold barbecues. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you're not going to go up to Mr. Jones, who you've seen every year holding a barbecue in front of his house, and start looking through his cooler. You know that man. You know, if you're an officer from that town, you're familiar with the people, and you know who to, you know, who to be suspicious of and who to leave alone.
What are you hearing from law enforcement officers? Is there sense we can do this, we can get this done, or 26.2 miles is a long, long path of exposure if you choose to look at it that way?
The message, what I've been hearing, is that they feel very ready. They feel like they've been coordinated. They feel like they've been doing this. They've been planning this for months. They feel very confident. And that's been the message they've been sending out. They've just been asking people, please be practical. You will help us do our job a lot more easily, and you'll be able to enjoy the event as well.
Maria Kramer, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Maria Kramer is following preparations for this year's Boston Marathon for the Boston Globe. The newspaper just won a Pulitzer Prize for its coverage of the Boston Marathon bombings a year ago today. You can continue this conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. We're thinking today of all those who suffered a year ago and wishing them the best on this anniversary day. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.